Nearly 100 horses in the Tonto National Forest were going to be rounded up starting this week. But loud protests caused the Forest Service to pull back for at least a month.
Americans definitely do feel some attachment to horses. This relationship between humans and the horses is probably second only to humans and dogs.
I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, we knew millennials liked Instagram and craft beer, but they're also turning to farming. And 4 decades later, Vietnam veterans finally face their PTSD.
I carried that guilt for a long, long time, and it kept biting me. It kept biting me over and over.
Plus, Phoenix is one of the worst cities for red light runners, and we say goodbye to The Daily Show's Jon Stewart. That and more up next on the show, after a check of this hour's news.
Support for NPR comes from the sustaining members of KJZZ and from Emily and Antoine Van Ochtmail, supporting New Futures, which works to help low-income D.C. area youth graduate from community college or certificate programs and become financially self-sufficient. Information is available at newfuturesdc.org.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein. Hope you're having a great afternoon. Valley weather for today. We're expecting partly cloudy skies for the rest of this afternoon with a high temperature to reach 108. And then for tonight, partly cloudy skies, a 30% chance for rain and lows in the mid to upper 80s. A 20% chance for rain tomorrow around the valley with a high of 106. Currently, relative humidity is at 25%. It's cloudy and 99 degrees. Meanwhile, in a check of valley traffic, right lane is blocked. 202 eastbound, an accident at the Center Parkway. Arizona Attorney General Mark Brnovich has requested a stay against the federal government. He's trying to prevent the Environmental Protection Agency from implementing its Clean Power Initiative announced earlier this week. As KJZZ's Phil Latzman tells us, the Attorney General believes the plan is fundamentally flawed and unlawful.
Brnovich says the Obama administration does not have the legal authority to issue the mandate. He's joined attorneys general in 15 other states in filing a stay against the Clean Power Plan. Even though the EPA reduced its original emission standards for Arizona, Brnovich says the edict is an overreach, will be costly for consumers, and could create other problems.
That's still going to have a significant impact on Arizona's economy and our utility rates, and possibly even create brownouts in the future. But the second issue is whether the EPA even has the authority to do so. We know that they're relying on a 4-decade-old law that wasn't even meant to address carbon emissions.
Brnovich, who accuses the administration of using the EPA to bypass Congress, says the stay would allow the courts to weigh in on the legality of the rule before it is implemented. Phil Latzman, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
The Vietnam War ended decades ago. Veterans from that conflict are now in their 50s and 60s and are starting to retire. And with retirement for some, there's a troubling realization that they have deep wounds from the war that have never healed. New research shows that hundreds of thousands of Vietnam vets are still suffering from the traumatic after effects of war. KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins reports.
It took Chuck Byers almost 40 years before he was able to think about his service in Vietnam. There was one day in particular that he tried to forget.
A lot of heavy fire that day. It was a bad day, June 1st, 1968.
Chuck was a combat medic known by the call sign Big Band-Aid.
Here's a picture of me. I mean, we were all pretty young.
Looking at photos of himself from decades ago, he tells the story. He had 23 days left before he could go home, when he got a call saying his unit was under attack. He and a fellow medic flew to the combat area and started patching up the wounded men. Chuck was performing a tracheotomy in the middle of a fierce firefight.
And just as I inserted the tube, I got hit. I took an AK-47 in my arm and in my gut.
He was taken to a field hospital and stitched back together. But his fellow medic, he was killed during the combat. And Chuck wondered, why was he the lucky one? Why had he survived while his friend had died?
And so I carried that guilt for a long, long time.
When he came back to the States, he was only 22 years old. He didn't have any time to comprehend what he'd gone through, and the war he'd served in was very unpopular. So he put his uniform away in a drawer and tried to forget.
But it came back and it kept biting me. It kept biting me over and over. It bit me in relationships. It bit me in my jobs.
By his own count, he had more than 20 jobs over the course of the next 35 years.
But every time I really was doing well, I'd sabotage myself, and I couldn't understand why.
But it took Chuck several decades to seek out an answer, and unfortunately, he's not alone. New findings from the National Vietnam Veterans Longitudinal Study estimate more than 200,000 Vietnam veterans like Chuck are still suffering from trauma, now known as post-traumatic stress disorder. It wasn't even a diagnosis back in the 70s, but now, for many older vets, it's all coming back.
And their symptoms are skyrocketing because work has historically been one of the ways they coped and function, is just pushing it out of their head, keeping busy, busy, busy.
Dr. Carrie Salamanca is a clinical psychologist at the Phoenix VA. She says the very nature of military training has kept many veterans from seeking help.
And they're taught really good skills to be soldiers and Marines and airmen, to just lock all that stuff down and put it away and, you know, soldier through. And that skill keeps them from seeking care and keeps them from healing.
Her caseload is full of Vietnam veterans like Chuck that now, finally, have the time to reflect on their lives. Others come in because they have no choice but to get treatment.
And that's what we see with the PTSD. When it gets to the point where they can no longer function, they come in for care. Which is unfortunate, because if they came in sooner, we could help them get better before it becomes dysfunctional in their life.
So as a new batch of veterans return from today's wars, the VA is trying to get them to seek help right away.
I definitely wouldn't be the person I am today, as cliche as that is, without the help I received from that therapist.
Evan Phillips is an intelligence analyst now serving in the Air Force Reserves, but for 4 years he was active duty, and he spent a year in Afghanistan. His team flew 20,000 feet above the battlefield in a small plane, providing logistics for ground forces. The trauma he experienced came from watching the horrors of war from afar, and from one specific incident that changed his life.
We were flying a typical night mission and encountered a pretty significant storm and fell about 10,000 feet. And it was probably 20 seconds of essentially free fall.
It was terrifying. Obviously, Evan's plane landed safely. He survived, but another surveillance plane crashed shortly after. Like Chuck, Evan suffered from survivor's guilt and the trauma of his own near-death experience. At the encouragement of the Air Force, he sought counseling soon after, where he learned breathing techniques that allowed him to get back on an airplane. Dealing with his fears up front is a lesson he believes will benefit him in life beyond war.
It's essentially the idea that, you know, these traumas that military members experience are actually beneficial and can kind of bounce people to a better life.
Maybe not for all veterans, but for some, what's known as post-traumatic growth can finally make healing a real possibility. Jimmy Jenkins, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
The U.S. Department of Education recently issued a report indicating Arizona's college graduation rate was the lowest in the nation. That was followed by a news release from the Arizona Board of Regents calling for clarification and saying the state's three public universities are beating the national average. To clear things up, we called Ted Mitchell, undersecretary at the U.S. Education Department.
It's one of the reasons why we were careful in the report to identify graduation rates by different sectors. So in the report, we've got a sector on the three publics, on private institutions, and then for for-profit institutions. And as you look across those, you do see that the for-profit, the low graduation rate in for-profit institutions does compromise the graduation rate in the others, which are right around the national average. So I think it begs the question about low for-profit graduation rate, and I think it's one of the things that we are hoping states take quite seriously in their role as authorizers of institutions of higher education to make sure that states, including Arizona, are only supporting institutions that are doing good service to their students.
Is there a concern at the administration level with how for-profits are being run?
Consistently, for-profits rank lower than the other segments. But to be fair, for-profits also provide educational opportunity to many students who don't qualify for admission to either the public sector or the independent sector. So I think that we need to look at those numbers with a little bit of scrutiny.
When we think about certain states that are well above the national average, let's say in terms of graduation, is there a commonality there? Are there certain things that they're doing perhaps a little bit better than other states?
Well, I don't think that this is true in a one-for-one basis, Steve, but I think that one of the things that we're noting is that it's, as states disinvest from public higher education, it makes it much more difficult for individuals and families to afford the freight to get through in a timely way. And I'm afraid to tell you that Arizona is one of the worst offenders. The systematic disinvestment in higher education has been dramatic, and the impact on institutions and the citizens of the state, I think, is worrisome for all of us. It's remarkable that against that tide, Arizona State has done a remarkable job in continuing to make access affordable to students and to really create a bunch of quite impressive programs.
Is this a time where we're going to have to rely on non-governmental sources, or are you thinking that by having reports like this, it will illustrate to constituencies that they need to go to their legislatures and say, no, this is important to us, please invest more?
I don't think it's an either-or question. I think it's both. I think that we need to work on fundamental state fiscal support for institutions of higher education, and we need to innovate to achieve high outcomes for students of all ages, all walks of life, low-income students, first-generation college goers. We're going to need to have highly innovative practices to be able to reach all of them. I think what's basically missing from the conversation today is a recollection that higher education, indeed all of education, is a public good, and that investments that we make in higher education pay off not just for the graduates, but for society as a whole.
Ted Mitchell is Undersecretary at the U.S. Department of Education. Mr. Mitchell, thanks for the time.
Thank you very much.
When you're driving around Phoenix and you're stopped at an intersection, take an extra second when the light turns green. That seems to be the message of a report issued by the National Coalition for Safer Roads. It lists Phoenix as the second most dangerous city in America for red light running. 127 people died in red light crashes in the city from 2004 to 2013. Jordan Hibbs is president of the Valley-based Red Means Stop Traffic Safety Alliance. The organization was started by parents of children who were killed or seriously injured by red light runners. Jordan, how seriously do people take red light running?
I think at first when people talk about red light running, they don't take it as seriously when they meet a victim or someone who's been impacted by a red light runner. When you hear about the stories where people have lost lives or their lives have been significantly altered by the effects of a red light running crash, people take it more seriously, but we aren't reminded about that on a daily basis of the effect of running a red light. But it does take lives, and it is something that should be taken seriously.
What methods or what things have been tried to change the tide of this, to make it so it's less dangerous driving around than it is?
Our organization has a few different approaches to educating the public. We go to high schools, then we go to community events, and we try to get to teenagers who then are able to transmit that information to their parents, because oftentimes adults are texting and they're busy and they're running red lights with their kids in the car or without their kids in the car. But if we can get to the teenagers, often we can get to the parents as well. Another approach that we have is that we offer a scholarship program to young teens in Arizona who aren't able to afford driver training. And we go through all of the importances of staying responsible on the road, and we put a big emphasis on not running red lights.
Is there something about Phoenix that makes Phoenix more dangerous? Is the street design stranger? Do people drive in a different way here?
Any urban area is going to have a higher rate of red light runners and red light running crashes. So it's not surprising that Phoenix and Tucson are on that top 10 list, because the urban areas, and it's really at any intersection with a traffic signal, is where you're going to see red light running. You don't obviously see that at a roundabout, because they're designed in a way that you can't hit someone at that degree.
Is distracted driving related to red light running?
Distracted driving absolutely contributes to running red lights. Another is speed as well. So there's many different factors why people go through red lights, and oftentimes it's a conscious decision, and people need to be aware of how fast they're going, what they're doing when they're approaching intersections, and really at all times they need to be focusing on driving cautiously and driving and following speeds on the road.
Of course, over the last few years, there's been discussion about the effectiveness of red light cameras, and some people are strong advocates for it, others are not. Does the organization have a strong view on that one way or the other?
As an organization, Red Means Stop does approve of red light cameras when they are well calibrated and fair. So we do support them because we do believe that they save lives of people against people who are running red lights.
Jordan Hibbs, president of the Valley-based Red Means Stop Traffic Safety Alliance. Coming up, you could watch your future home being built brick by brick.
With a live webcam, you actually truly can see what exactly is happening at any given moment.
The increasing presence of 24/7 construction cameras and related privacy concerns, it's the show. Good afternoon in Valley weather for the rest of this afternoon. We should have partly cloudy skies, looking for a high temperature to reach close to 108. That seems pretty far-fetched at this point, but we'll see what happens. Then partly cloudy skies for tonight, a 30% chance for rain and lows in the mid-80s. And then for tomorrow, 20% chance of afternoon showers and a high of 106. Currently, it's mostly cloudy and 99 here at KJZZ. In Valley traffic, an accident on the 202 eastbound at the Center Parkway started to cause a backup. Watch out there. And also there's a collision on the 60 westbound Grand Avenue at Greenway Road. It's 219.
KJZZ is supported by Moores & Cabot Investments and D.N. Griebel in their Mesa branch. Moores & Cabot is a 125-year-old national wealth management firm that is a member of the New York Stock Exchange, FINRA, and SIPC.
Construction cameras are starting to be used by real estate brokers as a way of giving anyone, especially buyers, real-time coverage of their future home being built. Phoenix-based Cambridge Properties is on board with its in-progress home community, Two Biltmore Estates. Keith Mishkin is a broker for Cambridge.
A lot of people talk about activity and that they're working on their construction and moving things forward, and you know, with a live webcam, you actually truly can see what exactly is happening at any given moment. And then also when you add that with the time-lapse delay, it really tells a really fun picture of, you know, watching everything go up.
Have you noticed what kind of traffic you've had? Is it as expected, better than expected?
We actually are getting a fair amount of traffic on that. We've added that to our website at twobiltmorehomes.com. And we just got our first lead that came in, and they said, hey, I noticed that you guys are underway, and we're so excited about that. And they came in, and we're actually very close to putting a sale together with them.
I was wondering whether the stream had helped you speak with out-of-state buyers about the project who may not just be able to jump on a plane and come see it in person. This might help.
Well, in this instance, it definitely did, and they said you know, they wanted to be able to get a sense of what their view and their vista is, and we were able to show them exactly where it is, and the wall is going up right now, and I said that we're going to be able to be in a position in another 3 weeks to walk out onto the floor that you're talking about, and we could schedule a time to go and do that, and you could truly see, and we could stand in your kitchen and in your great room, in your master bedroom, and show you this is what your experience will be like and what you'll see going out there and really starting to paint the picture. And when we say that we can do that in 3 weeks, they could look out and they'd say, oh, yeah, you're right. There's the wall going up. The floor over there was poured, and, you know, and we're off to the races there. And so it actually wound up being a fantastic tool for us with this client.
So, Keith, based on what we've been talking about, is this something that you could see expanding and continuing to be with big projects in the future, that this makes sense going forward? Are there any pitfalls you're thinking of?
From my perspective, it's all positive. I think it's really, really fun. I think it costs so little, why not go and do that? I could see the only pitfall is maybe some contractors having concern from a construction defects standpoint, that you have this additional history that's there that, while most of the time will help you, can be a detriment.
Keith, have you been tempted to look? You ever check it out?
Of course. Of course. You know, I was on vacation too, and they would say, the team said, "Oh my gosh, the wall's going up." I'm like, "Oh, I got to go see that." And the fun thing too, from a sales perspective too, what I like about that is them being able to call up people. You know, there were a few earlier naysayers saying, "Oh, I'll believe it when I see it," and then just literally emailing the link to people to be able, you know, for them to say, "Hey, go and look at it. It's going up. This is live. And by the way, we only have a few opportunities that are left right now. Here's what we've already sold. I know, you know, if you're telling me you're really interested, it's very real."
Keith Mishkin, broker for Cambridge Properties. So from a sales standpoint, 24/7 cameras sound like a winner, but there is some concern about other issues related to the real-time coverage. Denise Blommel, a Valley attorney who specializes in employment and labor law, lists a few.
I can see three definite issues. One is the reasonable expectation of privacy. Number two is, what if an individual employee's face were to be captured on camera and then used again? And number three deals with an area of law that a lot of employers tend to forget about, and that's the National Labor Relations Act.
Can you condense that for us as to why that would be a concern?
Sure. Section 7 of the National Labor Relations Act, which is enjoying its 80th year this year, deals with an employee, a non-supervisory employee's right to engage in protected concerted activity. And this applies to employees in the private sector. And these employees have the right to talk about wages, hours, and working conditions. Well, they also can do other types of concerted activities for what the law talks about, mutual aid and protection. So if these roving cameras were to pick up a meeting, for example, of employees talking about, gee, tomorrow we're going to go out on strike, which is kind of, an extreme version of this. But let's say employees were getting together and talking about, gee, we're not getting paid overtime. We've got a real issue with that. And these cameras were to pick up that meeting, this could be considered surveillance and might violate Section 8A1 of the National Labor Relations Act.
Have we seen an erosion of privacy as far as employment is concerned? And does any of that result from the fact that we went through a horrible recession and a lot of people were out of work?
It has. And also, I think that especially with our younger members of the workforce, we have a love-hate relationship with privacy in this country. Our Arizona Employment Law Handbook, which is a publication of the State Bar, has a really good article about privacy. The invasion of privacy under Arizona law, which can be a tort, you know, a civil wrong, it's really hard to prove. You have to prove pretty stringent standard of proof. You have to prove that it's highly offensive to a reasonable person. So, for example, if this roving camera were in the ladies' room, that's a different scenario than if this roving camera were just around the general work areas.
Denise Blommel is a Valley attorney who specializes in employment and labor law. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein with Mark Brody.
When you think about the Valley, is there a specific place you think of, a place that exemplifies your image of our desert home? That's a question we're posing in a new occasional series we're calling In a Place. We'll be asking architects about what gives them a sense of place for the Valley. Today, we hear from Matthew Salinger of Tempe-based CoLab Studio.
This is Casey Moore's Oyster House on 9th and Ash in Tempe. The restaurant has existed here one way or another as a bar and restaurant for decades. And this is one of my favorite places in Phoenix for a number of reasons. But you know, when we talk about a place that has meaning, the word authenticity often comes up. One of the things that's interesting about Casey's is in its place in a sense of what makes Phoenix what it is. Casey's has this neat environment where we're surrounded by a lot of wood, and it's old, messed up wood. Right next to me are these railroad ties that make up the exterior wall that block off the exterior environment from this patio. And that ties into the railroad, which is actually just a couple hundred yards to the west. All of this old trellis wood with old vines, bougainvillea, growing on it. They have some hanging plants and whatnot. The palm trees that are around the sides and the shade that's here, those are so indicative of Phoenix and the things that we need. There's also the sound of running water with the fountain that's there. There's some koi in there. It's really nice. But that fountain has a cooling psychological effect. And those are things that are really critical to making a nice, welcoming space in Phoenix. This space, too, that we're sitting in is a little bit sunken from the rest of the spaces around it. There's a couple of steps that go up alongside the fountain. And if you walk in the other direction, you have to walk up a little bit of a ramp to get to the regular kind of patio. That, you know, that all, again, has this sense of, provides a really good sense of place, kind of digging into the earth a little bit. We're lower than the parking lot. We're lower than other places. Again, it has a little bit of a psychological cooling effect.
Sitting here, one of the things that is interesting to me is that we're very close to downtown Tempe, obviously very close to the airport. You can hear the planes going overhead. But with the fence here, the railroad ties here and the fountains and all the trees and everything, it feels very secluded. Like you could very easily forget for a minute where you are in Tempe, much less the fact that you're even in Tempe.
Sort of, except again, I think there's all of this, these things around us that remind us that we're in the Southwest. I mean, yes, this could be, in a sense, in the middle of ASU's campus, or it could be way deeper in the neighborhood, further away from downtown Tempe. But there are all of these visual clues that you are in the Southwest. The house that's here, for instance, is over 100 years old, and it's very grounded in the architecture of the 9th and Ash area, that kind of Arizona craftsman style, in a way. And to me, it's impossible to separate this space from Tempe in a way, or from Greater Phoenix in that sense. But it is yet a very comfortable space. I think the seclusion allows it to be very comfortable and not really take away from a sense of place. It actually adds to it in a sense.
Why do you think it is that there aren't more places just to sort of be outside?
Air conditioning, I mean, and the heat. You know, I think we've gotten babied and pampered a lot by it. And I think as we get more cosmopolitan, I think we tend to drop away some of these places that, you know, create a kind of a historic sense of place. I think these places are important to maintain just to have a continuity of our connection to history.
Matthew Salinger is an artist and architect with CoLab Studio. We met on the patio at Casey Moore's Oyster House in Tempe. Let us know what spot gives you a sense of place for the Valley. Email us at theshow@kjzz.org or tweet at us at @KJZZPhoenix using the hashtag KJZZInAPlace.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
I'm Bill Murphy, and I'm a mechanic at Classic Corner Garage. I come in here every day and work on beautiful cars. We get these cars in, we pull the body off the frame. New brake lines, new brakes, you know, new gas lines, sometimes gas tanks. I build engines, I do the drivetrain, steering, suspension. The muscle car is just a raw, powerful machine. There's nothing quite like stomping on a 426 Hemi with 2.4 barrels, you know, and it's just it's a handful of car. And you know, it's not just a car. You know, I'm building somebody's dream or completing somebody's memory. It's not just the vehicle itself. I think it's the mindset.
That was Bill Murphy restoring a car at Classic Corner Garage. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or just think we need a tune-up, send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org. Coming up, farming and farmers are changing.
We've seen a lot of farmers age out, sell their land, but there's a kind of a new generation of people of all ages.
Why millennials are returning to the fields and how they're using genetics to improve the quality of their crops and herds. It's the show. Good afternoon to the Valley Freeways at this hour. An accident, I-17 southbound at Bethany Home, is blocking the off-ramp. Use Glendale as an alternative. We're also seeing a little bit of heavy slowing on the 51 northbound just past Thomas Road. Valley weather for the rest of this afternoon. It will stay partly cloudy. Probably won't get any rain this afternoon, but there is a 30% chance for showers tonight. A dust storm, also a possibility. Look for lows to be in the mid-80s. And for tomorrow, partly cloudy, a high of 106, and a 20% chance of an afternoon storm. Currently, relative humidity is at 25%. The dew point temperature is up to 58. It's partly cloudy and 99 degrees at 2:33.
KJZZ is supported by Min Music Theater, announcing the fall concert season, including artists such as Liz Wright, Patricia Barber, Marty Ashby, Joey Alexander, and more. Full lineup and tickets at mim.org.
It's the show on KJZZ with Steve Goldstein. I'm Phil Latzman. When we think about farmers, we don't necessarily think of them as young. I mean, even poor McDonald was old, right? But that may be changing.
We've seen a lot of farmers age out, sell their land, but there's a kind of a new generation of people of all ages that are very interested in learning to work the land and try to make a living at it.
That's Kelly Young. She's an agroecologist with the University of Arizona's Cooperative Extension in Maricopa County. She's working with millennials returning to the fields who are trying to flip that script.
According to census data I'm looking at, the average age of a farmer in the United States is 58.
Right.
And a very small fraction of the more than 2 million farms that are operated in this country are operated by 34-year-olds and under, I think about 119,000 from what I see. So are you telling me that young people are getting back into farming? Because right now, at least from the latest stats that we can see, that we have access to, it doesn't look that way.
Right. I mean, and if you look at Arizona, the average age is 61, I mean, that, which is even more frightening if you think about it. The people that know how to grow our food are aging out of the industry. But yes, there are a number of young people that are really interested in living off the land and providing nice lifestyles for their families.
But can they do that realistically? Can they make enough money to farm in Maricopa County in Arizona to be able to support their families?
It's very, very challenging, to be honest. And most young families have somebody that works off farm. You have to have that second income for the benefits and for the money. So people really don't go into food farming for money, especially in an urban agriculture, an urban environment, because they're just the profit margins are very, very slim. And we try to warn people that this is not, you're not going to make a fortune at this. This is a lifestyle choice, not a make cash quick scenario.
And not only in an urban environment, but in an urban environment that's dry,
right.
Water and irrigation is not always something that can be relied on. How difficult does that make it for the new farmers to start up?
That's one of the biggest problems that they have, is getting access to land that has good irrigation, that has access to the water they need to grow their crops. There's only finite land that's zoned for agriculture and that has access to agricultural water. A lot of the new people that are coming in have to use municipal water, which is very, very expensive. It's good quality water, but it's municipal water. So it is very hard to find good farmland that has enough water to produce a good crop.
Is the reason that you see more young people getting into farming because of the attention that GMOs have gotten? Maybe it's more of an idealistic approach for young people. They want to know what they're eating, and they want to make sure that it's not being biologically manufactured.
That's a really complicated question, because food is so personal. And there's, I mean, if you go on Netflix, there's so many documentaries about food and farming, and there's a lot of inaccuracies. There's so many misperceptions about what really goes on in farms. There's a lot of misinformation and misconceptions about GMOs. And so I think that is a part of it. I think there's a kind of a fear and distrust of agriculture, which is really unfortunate. But maybe, you know, it's reawakening this need to understand where food comes from.
That's Kelly Young, an agroecologist with the University of Arizona's Cooperative Extension in Maricopa County. So we went to look for one of those millennial farmers here in the valley, and we found Wes Kerr. Wes is a 31-year-old fourth-generation farmer who has 1,000 cows on his dairy farm in West Buckeye. Wes got interested in genetics and figured out a way to genetically modify his Holstein cows so they no longer grow horns. Yeah, it sounds a little strange, but he says it makes his farm safer and ultimately more productive, without animals that can hurt each other. We discussed what it was like to be a farmer on the younger side of the demographic pool, and whether he would advise others to follow in his footsteps.
Yeah, I do encourage people to become farmers. It's difficult. It is expensive to get started trying to find land and water and the knowledge. It takes a lot, but I want people to try to grow their food, to understand all that goes into it, that it's not just as simple as, oh, put the seed in the ground, water it, and harvest. It's like, whoa, you know, there's so many things that you're having to deal with, weather, pests, different things that you never know what could possibly happen to your crop. And so when people realize the complexity that it takes to grow food, I think they can appreciate it more, the work that went into it. It is a lifestyle choice completely. If you don't love it, you shouldn't do it. Last night I was out, we had a cow that was delivering twins, and this was 9 o'clock at night last night, and I was out helping her deliver her set of twins, and it was a difficult delivery. We were able to get them out, but that's one example of, that was 9 o'clock at night, and I had been up at 5 that morning working with the cattle too. So while most people talk about a 9-to-5 job, quite oftentimes farming will be from 5 a.m. to 9 p.m.
So you have a wife who is, ironically enough, a fourth-generation farmer as well, and you have children of your own. Getting young people back into farming, you seem to be the exception, not the rule. What will it take to get people to come out of college, like with degrees and advanced degrees, to come back to the fields and work those long hours?
You know, as I see different crops and different opportunities out there, I look at economics as well. And so as we have to feed our growing world more and more, different price signals, I think, will help pull people in to the market. Arizona, we have our farms are larger compared to the average. And the reason why is because you need economies of scale. Our irrigation water is very expensive here, and the land is very expensive here. So to make it work, you need size. In other regions of the country, you can farm with less land, less cows, and still turn a profit. But out here in the West, those economies of scale are super important. So people who want to start up a farm, especially out in Arizona, I think that's a good goal. It's going to be difficult. I'm not going to pretend that it's not. But people who want to be involved in agriculture don't necessarily have to be a farmer per se. They can be an agronomist and work for 10 farmers and help those 10 farmers decide what crops can we grow, crop rotations and different management systems that we can use to grow better crops. So I guess I want young people especially to be interested in agriculture and not necessarily think I want to be a farmer, but hey, I want to work within agriculture to help support farmers, make them more efficient and more productive, whether that's a veterinarian to help take care of our farm animals, or like I said, agronomists or nutritionists. There's a huge different varieties of degrees that you can get that will keep you in agriculture, whether you're necessarily the farmer owner or not.
Wes Kerr is a dairy farmer from Buckeye. He's 31 years old, a fourth-generation farmer. Thanks for coming out and talking with us. Very interesting conversation.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Wild horses in the Tonto National Forest were on the verge of not being wild any longer. The U.S. Forest Service had announced plans to remove nearly 100 horses starting this weekend, labeling them unauthorized livestock. But once a passionate group of protesters got involved, and U.S. Senators Jeff Flake and John McCain voiced their concerns, the Forest Service pulled on the reins and said it will delay the process for at least a month. Professor Ed DeSteiger, author of the book Wild Horses of the West, explains why the so-called Salt River horses generated such controversy.
They're a group of horses, principally on the BLM, Bureau of Land Management land in the western United States that are protected under a 1971 federal law, and they can be removed from the land, but they have to go through certain steps. There's a procedural difference that the federal government has to go through, and it's possible for those protected horses to be adopted out to families that want to own a wild Mustang. But for the first year of adoption, they're scrutinized by the federal government and receive certain protection. These horses that are on the Tonto don't fall under that law, and they are basically regarded as unauthorized stray horses that ended up on federal land.
Why are horses so identified with the American West, and why do so many people feel such a closeness to Western horses?
Well, you know, I think the first thing that we can say is that Americans definitely do feel some attachment to horses, perhaps especially wild horses. This relationship between humans and the horses is probably second only to humans and dogs. It's a very, very strong relationship. Public opinion polls have indicated that the vast majority of the American public wants to see these animals protected. As to why this is the case, you'd have to be more of a psychologist than I am to actually answer that question.
Is there something that's missing about government management of wild horses? We hear stories about, oh, there's a horse roundup in Nevada. There's this going on in Arizona. Does all that make sense to someone who has the knowledge that you do, or are things a little bit in flux and odd?
Yeah, it does make sense. I'll say this, that the federal land managers, the Forest Service, the BLM, have responsibility under federal law to manage and care for the lands of the western United States, and there are many activities that go on out there. The horses are only one part of that, and so the agencies have to take into account all these different uses that are being made of the land and bring it all into balance. And they do have concerns about overpopulation of horses, that they could present some danger to recreationists, they could present some damage to cause damage to vehicles on the roads. They could overgraze. The public, though, and in particular these wild horse protection groups, love these animals. They want to see them protected at all cost. And this is where you get a tension between the two interest areas of interest, if you will. The main thing that the agencies need to do and take care to do is to make sure that they involve the public in these decisions, and if they don't, there's always a potential public relations fallout.
Ed DeSteiger, author of the book Wild Horses of the West. Earlier this summer, ASU conservation biologist Andrew Smith received the Aldo Leopold Award from the American Society of Mammalogists, primarily for work he'd done focusing on the importance of China's Tibetan Plateau pika, a tiny and furry mammal. Smith told us why an honor named for Aldo Leopold is so meaningful.
He's best known for the land ethic, that we should really think first about the land and how everything emanates from that. So he wasn't either an arch preservationist, or he wasn't completely a sustainability kind of guy, but he sort of charted the path that we should be thinking very clearly about what we should be doing in terms of how we made all of our conservation decisions. When Aldo Leopold actually left the Forest Service and became a professor, he actually wrote a book called Game Management, which there are very few people that you can say wrote a book and started a field of discipline. So there were no wildlife management or conservation departments in any university. And as a result of his book, which is still fantastic, even though it was written in 1930, set the stage for conservation becoming even an academic pursuit, not just an applied pursuit for the people that worked in organizations like the Forest Service.
What's the most significant conclusion, the most significant progress to come out of the work you did in the Tibetan Peninsula?
I work on cute little animals that are about 6 inches long with little round ears and shaped like an egg and no tail, called pikas. there are several species of pikas that live in Asia. And one of them is the plateau pika, which actually lives up in the high 14,000-foot, 13 to 15,000-foot meadows. But it was apparent to me that they were being poisoned with reckless abandon. There have been reports of almost like nine. There was one report in the China Daily, which is the English language arm of the Chinese press, but very, very much controlled, that said that actually gave a figure once of $934 million allocation toward controlling, i.e. poisoning, pikas. I mean, and this was in a national nature reserve, the Sanjiangyuan Three Great Rivers National Nature Reserve. Imagine if you had almost $1 billion to poison all the animals in Yosemite or Yellowstone National Park. It's just phenomenal. So the work that I've done has basically recast the pika as a keystone species for biodiversity. It's an animal that makes burrows. I don't have to tell you that probably at 15,000, 14,000 feet, there are no trees. So all the native birds only nest in pika burrows. If you poison the pikas, the burrows collapse, and that element of biodiversity simply disappears. Mm-hmm. The pikas are also the food source for almost every carnivorous bird and mammal, from weasels to steppe polecats to Pallas's cat, sort of an endangered cat, sort of looks a lot like the Cheshire cat. It's really a fascinating animal. Through wolves up to snow leopards, although snow leopards really love to eat blue sheep, but they also eat pikas too, to brown bears, which is our grizzly bear. So it's like 75 to 90% of the diet of grizzly bears, brown bears, on the Tibetan Plateau are pikas. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that we've done most recently, and one of the things that we're really proud of, is that we've said, okay, this is a watershed. And the extrapolation is that where pikas have been poisoned, there's going to be more sheet runoff, more potential for erosion, and could be loss of life and property downstream. And this is getting the attention of policymakers and may, I hope, ultimately lead to the cessation of the poisoning of these animals, which are keystone species for biodiversity.
How do we determine whether a species is required, is needed, that it is a loss, yes, but not as dramatic a loss as others would be?
It's a really tough question because we really don't know the answer to that question. Early on, one of the leading conservation biologist Paul Ehrlich likened all this to sort of getting on an airplane at one point in time, and someone was sort of popping rivets off the wing. I don't want to get on that airline. He said, well, no, the wing will stay on. There's no problem. We can sell all these rivets for 25 cents a piece, and we can increase our profit margin, you know. But the idea is we don't know when the last rivet will come off, and the wing will fall off, and you really don't want to get on that plane. He likened this to spaceship Earth. I mean, we only have one Earth. We really don't know the answer. The reason that ecology is a very imprecise science, and we're trying to always work to sort of answer these questions with greater precision, but it's very difficult. What conservation biologists do is we call it the precautionary principle, that you basically, you know, save all the moving parts because we don't know when we're really going to need some of those parts and when some of those parts are really necessary.
ASU conservation biologist Andrew Smith. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. In Valley traffic, there's an accident, I-17 southbound at Bethany Home, which is blocking the off-ramp. We're seeing some clearing skies here around the valley. Clouds will return tonight with a 30% chance for rain and lows in the mid-80s. It's currently partly cloudy and 99 degrees at 254.
KJZZ is supported by SRP, providing over 150 education grants last year to schools in our community, creating a foundation for future scientists, engineers, technicians, and tradespeople. More at srp4edu.com.
Careful, Arizona. You turn history back too far, you'll go back to being that weird patch between New Mexico and California that no one wants to talk about, which really isn't that big a change, is it?
That was John Stewart lampooning Arizona in the midst of the 2014 religious freedom controversy. For 16 years, it seems no one was safe from Stewart's jabs, and tonight he'll sign off from The Daily Show for the last time. The show's been a phenomenon on U.S. television, of course, but it's also spawned spin-offs around the world and a number of copycats, and sometimes in places you might not expect. A case in point is Iraq. The BBC's Yolande Nell reports.
This is the sound that we've come to associate with news from Iraq. Video messages by Islamic State militants revealing their latest atrocities. But one Iraqi wants us to hear more of this. Ahmed Bashir used to be a conventional news anchor, but inspired by the US presenter Jon Stewart, he decided to take a new approach. The Bashir Show takes a satirical look at what's happening in Iraq, including the advances by IS or ISIL.
I think in Iraq we passed most of our problems by making jokes. So we made fun of every extremist in Iraq, like he was Sunni or Shia. We don't have difference in that. We made fun of ISIL in every episode.
In this sketch, IS fighters call a news conference. But they face uncomfortable questions about who supports them. And eventually, the frustrated militants ask the reporters to line up for a group photo. They open fire and shoot the cameras. In another episode, Ahmed tries to interview some supposedly pious teetotal IS members, only to find they're drunk. And that's a problem when one tries to show off his new belt to his friends. It's loaded with explosives. A crew of 23 people work on the show, all based in Jordan. They've received death threats in Iraq, so this is a relatively safe place. While researchers monitor dozens of Iraqi TV channels in one room, searching for video clips to use, the writers squabble over scripts in another. They're all young Iraqis in their 20s and 30s. Shawan Sadr is a writer and actor.
Everyone has like a different major, but it's really funny because everyone wants to work in entertainment. And most of them actually are our friends. We knew them even before the show. And that's it. Sometimes we argue a lot about like getting a joke, but at the end we actually like settle on something really good.
Since the program started last August, it's had over 20 million views on YouTube. Another writer, Faisal Adora, says they're finding ways to reach out to ordinary people.
It was a great response, to be honest. We never expected this much viewership or success, let's call it. It is really depressing in all areas. The only thing that all Iraqis would agree upon laughing about is our politics. The people that are pretending to care about us, and they're not.
Nouri al-Maliki, the former prime minister who's blamed for stoking sectarian violence, comes in for a lot of criticism. He's mocked with jokes, songs, and even rap music. But there's a very serious side. Shia Muslim militia killed Ahmed Bashir's own father and brother. He wants his show to overcome sectarian divisions, representing all Iraqis.
We have Kurds, we have Shia, we have Sunni, we have Christians, we have Turkoman. We miss one religion in Iraq, it's Yazidi. We are searching for someone. I call it the real Iraq. This is the real sample of Iraq.
Many people in Iraq have witnessed two or three wars. There's been terrible bloodshed. And now IS controls large areas, including Ahmed's home city, Ramadi. Despite it all, he believes in a positive future for his country, if only it remains intact.
The new generation, the Iraqi young guys, they are tired of what happened in the past 12 years. So I think in the future, yeah, they can change the situation in Iraq. And I think if they choose right, they will change everything back home. So this is what we are dreaming of.
As the turmoil continues just across the border, The Bashir Show has just begun its second season. For now, there's no shortage of news to satirize or viewers.
And that's the BBC's Yolande Nell. And that's all for today's edition of the show, but do not despair. We are back again tomorrow afternoon at 2. We'll visit another Valley Hot Corner and find out about a new Native American low-power radio station. That's Friday afternoon at 2 on KJZZ's The Show. And if you're looking for anything to do tonight, and who isn't? Boy, so many things to do. There's a Phoenix Poetry Slam tonight at 8 at Lawn Gnome in Phoenix. Also, the Bad Neighbors EP release show is tonight at 8 at the Crescent Ballroom in Phoenix. The show is produced by our senior producers, Jimmy Jenkins and Sarah Ventry, with help from Bruce Drummond, Anika Klein, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Regina Revozova, and Tiara Vian. Tracy Greer, Sky Shad, and Maria Springs are the digital team. Our news director is Al Macias. Our executive producer is John Hoban. For Mark Brody and Phil Latzman, I'm Steve Goldstein. All Things Considered is up next on member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. It's 3 o'clock.
Expanded local coverage of arts and culture, early childhood, and healthy aging is made possible by support from Virginia G. Piper Charitable Trust.